Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. The Supreme Court hadn't heard a case about gun rights for almost a decade until yesterday, when the justices heard a challenge to a New York City regulation that allowed residents to have a permit for a gun at home, but prohibited them from transporting it outside. Second Amendment advocates say that violates the constitutional right to bear arms. But here's the thing. New York has already repealed the policy in question. So those opposing the challenge say the case is moot and should be thrown out. And yet this could represent the biggest opportunity in years to get a newly conservative Supreme Court to expand Second Amendment rights. This hour On Point, the High Court and guns. You can join us. Do you think it's time for the Supreme Court to wade into the Second Amendment debate and the right to bear arms and to clarify what it really means? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington is David Savage. He's the Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He was in the courtroom yesterday for oral arguments. David, it's great to have you back on Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
So this is somewhat unusual, a challenge to a law that is no longer on the books. But let's back up a bit and explain why the New York Rifle and Pistol Association challenged this regulation to begin with. What did the regulation do precisely?
Well, in New York, you could get a license to have what was called a premises license. That is, you could have a license to have a gun at home. And the city said, we understand that part of being a gun owner is like training and all. So you can take your gun to a shooting range in the city, but you can't just like put your gun in a car and take it anywhere. It's a premises license. I should add, the city also had what was called a carry license, but those are hard to get. In cities like New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, you can obtain a, at least on the books, a right to carry a weapon, but you have to show some special need. You have to say, you know, I work in an area and I run a small business. I've got a lot of cash. I really need to be armed all the time. So these people didn't try to get a carry license because they probably couldn't get it. They got the premises permit and they said, oh, this is outrageous. If I want to take my gun to my second home up in Westchester or to a shooting range in New Jersey, they came up with all these examples and said, the city forbids me to do that. That violates the right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. It's sort of a setup case that the gun rights activists have been anxious for the Supreme Court to say that the Second Amendment isn't just a right to have a gun at home. It's a right to have a gun in public. And this was set up to be a challenge to just that notion.
So it's interesting, though. I want to come back to this idea, though, that New York took this law off the books. Understanding, I gather, that this would probably be struck down by the Supreme Court. So they took it off the books. So why is this before the court if it's no longer on the books?
Good question. I don't know the answer. So, yes, the court agreed to hear this case. Everybody on the city side and New York State said, uh-oh, we know where this is going. They took this case to reverse. That is, the lower courts had upheld the city. The Supreme Court's going to reverse. We better pull back on this law. And I take it to some degree, this regulation wasn't even really that well known. And the city said, okay, we'll repeal this rule that says you can't transport it to a shooting range outside the city. That's okay. And the New York legislature stepped in and passed a law that said you have a right to carry this gun to any other authorized location. So they tell the Supreme Court during the summer, hey, we've repealed these regulations. The case should go away. It's moot. And the Supreme Court refused to dismiss the case and said, we will consider it in the fall, including the mootness question. So I would have thought, as your question suggested, they would have said, okay, we don't need to decide this. It's settled. But they didn't. And so that leads me to think that at least four of them were – the Supreme Court doesn't like people to maneuver where you know, they take up a case and then suddenly the city or the state changes the law. So I think in principle they don't like that. But that's the only explanation I can have, is that four of them or five of them wanted to say, I'm serious, we should go ahead and decide this case anyway.
Mm. What's the principle? Or let me ask the question this way. How unusual is it for the Supreme Court to consider the constitutionality of a law that's not on the books? I mean, is there a precedent for this? Does it have a name? I'm just trying to wrap my head around what exactly is going on here.
I don't think there's a precedent that's very clear on this. What happens sometimes is a regulation or law gets repealed, or the police department says, we're no longer going to do this. We're no longer going to stop and frisk young men or whatever. And the people on the other side said, wait a minute, we've been fighting this for all these years. We don't trust the fact that the police really are going to stop and do this. We want a court ruling that says it's unconstitutional, for example, to stop and frisk people. So sometimes there's a debate about what's it really mean when the city says we're going to quit doing this. So I think at times the court wants to take a close look and really see that this, in this instance, this regulation really has gone away and is not being enforced in any way. But I don't know any governing – certainly the governing principle is if there's no live dispute, – the court should not rule on the case.
Really interesting. Let's listen to a little bit of tape from yesterday. Here's former U.S. Solicitor General Paul Clement. He's representing gun owners in New York, and he's talking outside the Supreme Court yesterday after arguments about why his clients filed this challenge.
The city of New York had resisted their efforts to vindicate their rights at every turn, and only when the Supreme Court granted the certiorari petition in this case did the city start to take efforts to try to recognize their rights.
And here's New York City Corporation Counsel James Johnson speaking in front of the Supreme Court after yesterday's oral arguments. He questioned why the case has even gotten this far.
New York City and New York State actually gave them everything that they had asked for before this argument. That was made very plain in this argument today. The case is moot. It is a case that should not have gone forward to this point.
David, I want to talk about what happened. We've been mentioning that this is the first case before the Supreme Court on Second Amendment rights in about 10 years. And that brings us back to the Heller decision, the first time in history that the court held that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to own a gun. But that decision also affirmed all kinds of gun regulations are permissible. So the significance of having this case 10 years after Heller. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. Heller was in one sense a landmark because, as you said, prior to that time, for most of American history, the court had interpreted the Second Amendment as something about militias. It says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So for most of American history, as I say, that was a right about having a militia, an armed militia. From about the 1970s on, the NRA focused on that phrase, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And most Americans, I think, had sort of come to believe that there is this constitutional right of me, an individual, not the militia, but me as an individual to have a gun. And the Supreme Court in the Heller case, as you mentioned, this was a D.C. ordinance, Washington, D.C. ordinance that banned the private possession of handguns. The Supreme Court struck that down on a 5-4 vote, said there is an individual right under the Second Amendment, and it's a right to have a handgun at home for self-defense. And 2 years later, they struck down a Chicago ordinance very similar. So a big precedent in the sense that, yes, there's an individual right, but notice it's a very limited right. It says you have this right to have a handgun at home. And in the years since then, the court has consistently refused to hear appeals where lower courts have upheld regulations. For example, cities and state laws in California, Massachusetts, that make it illegal to sell a semi-automatic weapons and big capacity magazines. The court has turned away challenges to those. It turned away challenges to laws that made it very hard to get a concealed carry permit, the thing I mentioned earlier, that yes, in New York, you can get a permit to carry a gun, but almost no one gets one. So the gun rights advocates have been very frustrated. Justice Clarence Thomas, among others, has sort of echoed that in a series of dissents. Neil Gorsuch, the first Trump appointee, a native of Colorado, appears to be a very big fan of gun rights, and so is Justice Alito, Justice Samuel Alito. So I would say there's three strong gun rights votes on the court. Then Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed last year, and Kavanaugh also wrote a very strong opinion. I thought the most extreme opinion I read of his on the appeals court, where he dissented when the D.C. ordinance was upheld that prohibited the high-capacity magazines and rapid-fire guns. He dissented and said that's a Second Amendment right. So that sort of sets the stage, is that a lot of people, particularly on the gun control side, said, uh-oh, there's four solid gun rights votes and then Chief Justice Roberts. So that's why there was a lot of concern on the liberal side, the city side, about this New York case, because they thought, we now have – it now looks like we may have a court that's prepared to go pretty far in the direction of gun rights.
David Savage, stand by. We're going to take a short break. Listeners, we're talking about New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City versus the City of New York. What questions do you have about this case around the Second Amendment and what it means about the future of gun rights and where the Supreme Court stands? David Savage was in the courtroom yesterday. When after the break, we're going to hear about what he saw of the justices ask and what that might suggest about this case. I'm Anthony Brooks. I'll be right back after a short break. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the Supreme Court and the Second Amendment and a challenge to a New York City ordinance that limited gun rights, but that has already been taken off the books. You can join the conversation. What gun laws have been passed in your own city or state? Do you feel they're too strict, that they violate your constitutional rights? David Savage is with me. He covers the Supreme Court and legal issues for the Los Angeles Times. And let's take a call. Spencer is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina, about this current case before the Supreme Court. Spencer, good to have you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How are you doing?
Very well.
My opinion in this is the lower court ruling still stands. And even though New York City and New York State have repeal the law, there's nothing there to stop them from putting that law back on further down the road. What needs to happen is there needs to be a wall put up by the Supreme Court to prevent these folks from doing that again.
Spencer, appreciate the call. David Savage, that represents a pretty strong statement in on behalf of why this challenge is before the Supreme Court, right?
Yes, and Justice Alito said basically that during the argument. He said, look, these people went to court because they wanted to challenge this law as being unconstitutional. They lost, but they want a court ruling that says it's unconstitutional under the Second Amendment to forbid a licensed gun owner from carrying his gun to a shooting range in the suburbs. It would be like my example of the stop and frisk case. If there's a lot of litigation, the plaintiffs who challenged that in the end would want a court ruling that says it's unconstitutional to stop and frisk innocent people on the streets or whatever. They want a clear ruling. And so, yes, the argument on the conservative side is that the court, those lower court precedents, as the caller said, are still on the books, and that the Supreme Court should say something and make it clear that they didn't agree with that view that gun rights can be restricted so much.
So, David, you were in the courtroom yesterday. What did you glean from questions from the justices? What do you think? Any hints about where they're leaning and where this case could take them?
I think the likelihood is that they will dismiss this as moot or issue some opinion to explain why it's moot. It was very easy to count to four. The four liberal justices made clear from the very beginning. Ruth Ginsburg said, look, the city, the state and the city gave these people everything they asked for. What's left of this case? Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, look, the other side's thrown in the towel. What are you complaining about? You know, you've got – so there are four votes on the left to throw out the case as moot. Chief Justice Roberts, who I think is really the one to watch in this case, asked a series of very careful questions, sort of probing, is there any way that any of these plaintiffs could be penalized for having violated the law? Or is there any possibility that you will enforce it in some new or different way? Like the caller said, maybe the city will turn around and start enforcing it again. And in each case, the city attorney said, absolutely not. We will not enforce this law in any way. We will not penalize anybody. We have nothing to do with this law going forward. And Roberts just seemed to be assuring himself that there was nothing left to decide here. And Brett Kavanaugh was uncharacteristically quiet. He didn't ask a single question. So just based on what I heard yesterday, I would think there's five or six votes to have this dismiss this case and have it go away.
I want to introduce another expert into this conversation. Joining us from Durham, North Carolina, is Joseph Blocher. He's co-director of the Duke Center for Firearms Law and a professor at Duke University Law School. And Professor Blocher, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Anthony.
I know you've been listening along to this conversation so far. Chime in any way you want, but I guess I'd like to ask you sort of the basic question, the significance in your view of this case at this moment before the Supreme Court.
Well, unfortunately, it's a hard question to answer because it's still unclear. I agree with the math in terms of counting up how many votes there are for mootness. It seems to be at least five, certainly four. And if the case goes that way, then we won't learn anything, at least from a court majority, about the future of Second Amendment doctrine. I wouldn't be surprised to see some dissenting opinions, even if the case gets dismissed as moot, addressing the merits of the Second Amendment question. But because of that, it still remains up in the air whether this is going to be a blockbuster Second Amendment case along the lines of the two cases you mentioned earlier, Heller and McDonald from 10 years ago, or whether the court is going to wait for another vehicle. And it has a lot of other petitions before it that it could choose from if it decides to dismiss this one.
Interesting. And I want to talk about those other cases that might be waiting in the wings. But Joseph Blocher, why are gun advocates so eager to get this particular case in front of the Supreme Court? I mean, where do they hope? What do they hope? Where do they hope that it goes?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think one thing that gun rights advocates and litigators have been wanting for a long time is a clear statement from the Supreme Court that the right to keep and bear arms extends outside the home. And that's a question that the court didn't clearly answer in District of Columbia versus Heller. As you all were talking about earlier in the conversation, the challenge there really was to a D.C. law which made it illegal with all but a few tiny exceptions for a person to have a handgun in the home. And so the court ruled, as the petitioner had asked, that the right extends to an individual right to keep handguns in the home for private purposes like self-defense. It didn't have to say, and therefore didn't say, clearly whether that right extends when you open your front door. Now, most lower courts have held or assumed that the right does, but that it maybe looks a little different in public places than it does in the home. And maybe the government has, as was true of other constitutional rights, more of a power to regulate. What gun rights advocates want, I think, and this case is sort of an unusual vehicle for it, is a clear statement from the Supreme Court that that's true, that the right does extend past your front door.
Really interesting. We've gotten a lot of comments from our listeners. I'm going to read a couple from Facebook and then go to our callers. NSTEF writes on Facebook, every developed country in the world has far stricter gun laws than us and far less gun violence. Gun right advocates refuse to acknowledge this evidence. And here's another comment from Creaker, who writes, prediction, by election time next year across much of the country, will be much easier to buy and own guns than it is to vote. And we've got a bunch of callers who are calling in at 1-800-423-8255 to get involved in this conversation. Let's go to Peter, who's calling from Marblehead, Mass. Go ahead, Peter. You're on the air. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi. I was the named plaintiff in a class action lawsuit in Los Angeles when I lived there. Was brought by gun rights organizations to compel the city of Los Angeles to grant us concealed weapons permits. Eight of us had very good reasons. I was on a death list because of my work fighting neo-Nazis. And after 2 years in the courts, we were granted that right. But the city of Los Angeles apparently is still dilatory about issuing the permits. So a suit like this, I think, has some merit.
All right, Peter, I appreciate that. David Savage, let me come back to you and to get you to respond to Peter's story there. I mean, that's really kind of another story about without the Supreme Court really sort of throwing up a wall and saying this law, even though it's not on the books, it can't come back, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's what Paul Clement wants. And that's what the caller suggested would have been better in Los Angeles, that you go to court, you seek a declaratory judgment, that is a declaration about what the law is, and then you want a final court ruling that says that, because then you can hold up the decision and say, see, I've got a right to do this, and you, the city, have to comply. And if the case stops short of a final ruling, you know, in this case, the gun rights advocates may not trust the city to fairly enforce the law or give them the rights that they thought they had won in court.
Really interesting. Let's take another call. Mary is calling from Pewaukee, Wisconsin. Mary, it's good to have you.
Thank you. Yeah, my comments today, I believe it's something like 80% of Americans want stricter gun control. Then why can't our president meet with the, is it bankrupt NRA or going bankrupt NRA, and change his mind every time he says he's going to enforce stricter laws? And why don't the GOP have, you know, more balls to do something about it when the public obviously wants more vetting and cutting out loopholes in the gun fair shows? I think the public is tired of this charade.
Mary, thanks so much for the call. Joseph Loker, I'd like to ask you about sort of public attitudes toward this. I'm looking at one recent PBS NewsHour poll from September. It says 72% want a national red flag law. That's an extreme risk protection law, which would allow essentially family members to have guns removed from people in their family they're worried are going to harm themselves or harm other people with guns. But speak to the caller's question about public attitudes about gun control and perhaps how that's evolved over the years.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think to answer it, you have to look at particular kinds of gun laws. If you ask just generally, do you support stricter gun laws, you get one answer. But if you ask people particularly, do you support, for example, expanded background checks, or do you support bans on high-capacity magazines, you sometimes get different answers. It tends to be that when you ask people about particular policies, and I'll just pick expanded background checks, the support is even higher. With expanded background checks, the polling numbers are pretty extraordinary, and you know, some of them will show 80 to 90% of Americans, 75% of gun owners, high majorities even of NRA members support expanded background checks. And yet, you know, the strongest, most recent push anyway for federal expanded background checks was in the wake of Sandy Hook, and it didn't make it out of the Senate. And that was before President Trump, of course, but the federal will hasn't necessarily been there. But I would say additionally that a lot of the action has been at the state level and at the local level. And this was true after Sandy Hook. It's been especially true after Parkland. So those extreme risk protection laws that you mentioned are state laws. And I think 17 states now have adopted them, almost all of them just in the last 2 or 3 years. So even if Congress doesn't do anything, even if the president doesn't do anything, there's still some room at the state level. And one more quick comment on that, which goes to the prior caller's concern about the New York regulation going back into force. I mean, there's another reason that can't happen, which is not just New York City's representations, but also the fact that New York State passed a law over the summer regulating and forbidding the kinds of regulations that New York used to have. So it's now prohibited by state law that New York City could ever put that regulation back into effect, which I think gives a little more of a little more than just an assurance.
I'm glad you mentioned the state laws and that the sort of action on gun control over the last few years has really been at the state level, because there is this idea that's true that since Sandy Hook in 2012, there's been very little done at the federal level. But the states have stepped in a big way. So my question is, does a case like this, if the Supreme Court takes it up, does it put those laws that have been passed at the state level at risk? I don't know if you want to take that up, David.
Well, it certainly could. And I think I agree with both of you about the action at the state level. And I think one of the good things that's happened in the last 10 years with the Supreme Court, and maybe will continue if this case is dismissed, which is the court has set sort of a bottom line principle that every person, every American law, and can have a gun at home for self-defense. But we're not going to interfere anymore with that. Stand back. And what that's allowed is states like Massachusetts and Connecticut and New York and California can enact stricter gun control measures. Surely Texas and Mississippi are not going to do so. You don't need the Second Amendment in federal court to win gun rights in Texas. Texas is not going to limit gun rights. But the gun rights people want to go to the court and limit the ability of Massachusetts or California to enact stricter gun control measures. And so I think there's something to be said for the fact if the Supreme Court just sort of stands back and says very little, it allows states around the country to go different ways on the issue of gun control.
Let's go to Christopher, who's calling from Norwich, New York. Christopher, go ahead. You're on the air. It's good to have you. Thanks for the call.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Tell me what's on your mind.
Okay. So this is honestly a major concern of mine, because I have my concealed carry, which I went through all the steps to go through. And believe me, in New York, there are many steps you must go through. You have to shell out a considerable amount of money, too. It's quite expensive to get your concealed carry permit. So one of the things that we have to do, one of the steps, is we have to go to a basic pistol safety course. Furthermore, you have to go one step farther and go to a concealed carry course, where they basically go over the rules and regulations of the justification of use of deadly physical force and so on. But for me, to tell me that all those steps that I went through are no longer applicable for me to take my firearm, my concealed carry weapon, into one of the most dangerous places in New York is just a blatant infringement on my Second Amendment rights. And the Second Amendment is very, very clear that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It doesn't say the right of the people or the right of the militia to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It says the right of the people.
Well, Christopher, thanks so much for the call, and we appreciate where you're coming from. Joseph Blocher, talk to Christopher's point and his, you know, he has a pretty clear interpretation about what that Second Amendment says. But even Heller decision left room for some regulation, as we've been discussing, right? I mean, do you want to sort of add to his definition of the Second Amendment?
Sure, I'm happy to talk about it. I mean, the words that Christopher's focusing on there, that shall not be infringed in the Second Amendment, certainly, you know, read clearly to some, but that's not how even Justice Scalia, in his very originalist and very strong gun rights opinion in Heller, interpreted those words. That's not how we interpret other constitutional rights. You know, the First Amendment begins with Congress shall make no law, and yet there's all kinds of restrictions on speech which are constitutional. The hard questions are which kinds of regulations are constitutional. And I'd say, just on concealed carry in particular, you know, I sympathize with the cost and effort of having to go get a permit, but Justice Scalia says in Heller, again, looking at the historical record, that the very act of concealed carrying itself is not clearly protected by the Second Amendment at all, that historically that's something that states, beginning maybe surprisingly in the South, have historically regulated quite tightly. So it's not clear that that activity itself is even covered by the words keep and bear in the Second Amendment. I mean, the really hard questions, I think, are not the absolute views one way or the other that all gun regulation is okay or that none of it is. The hard questions are, How do you accommodate these two different strains of historical and constitutional commitment that we have to gun rights on the one hand, which we do have, and gun regulation on the other hand, which we do have and have had since the founding? And so they're practical, detailed questions, and you can't answer them, I think, with those kinds of generalities.
Boy, very practical and very detailed questions, and we're exploring them all right now. We're talking about a challenge to a New York City regulation that is no longer on the books, but that is before the U.S. Supreme Court, and we're discussing the Second Amendment. You can join the conversation. What does the right to bear arms mean to you? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about a Supreme Court challenge to a New York regulation on guns that's no longer on the books, but that could open the way to larger challenges, bigger challenges to other gun laws around the country. We're talking about guns, the Supreme Court. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. So here's Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy. He's a Democrat. He's been a leader on gun control since his home state was devastated by the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. He spoke to gun safety supporters outside the Supreme Court yesterday.
They're going to try to get the courts to protect them because the voters won't protect them any longer. Because we, for the first time in a long time, we, the anti-gun violence movement, are finally stronger than the gun lobby is.
Now, the U.S. Supreme Court first ruled on an individual's right to bear arms in 2008 in the District of Columbia versus Heller. It was a 5-4 vote. The court ruled that Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban was unconstitutional, but it also allowed room for gun regulation. So here's Alan Gura, the attorney representing gun owners, reacting to that 2008 decision.
It basically told us what Americans had long suspected. We do have an individual right in this country to have guns. The government cannot ban guns, and it cannot regulate guns out of existence.
I'm here with David Savage, who covers the Supreme Court and legal issues for the Los Angeles Times, and Joseph Bloker, the co-director of the Duke Center for Firearms Law and a professor at Duke University Law School. And David, Joseph, I want to go back to our phones. We've still got a lot of callers who'd like to get in on this conversation. Brian is calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Brian, go ahead. Good to have you.
Hi. I think we're missing the pink elephant in the room. I mean, even what happened, if you look at what happened in London, suppose he had a legally right to carry a weapon, you know, a firearm in that situation. So, you know, some of us are going to have to be a little discomfortable, you know, and I respect the guy who, you had a caller who went through training and this and that, yes, but he's not general society, you know. We need to be more stringent and, you know, you shouldn't just be able to just nilly-willy just carry, go and purchase a weapon, you know. And we look at the kids are being punished by our weapon laws already. You know, they have to, in the school system, they have to go through these, you know, active shooter drills and, you know.
Brian, we hear you loud and clear, and there are certainly numbers that alarm a lot of people. I'm looking at some statistics right now at the Gun Violence Archive. Total number of gun deaths so far this year, about 36,000. 14,000 are homicides, 22,000 are suicides, 389 mass shootings. Among those killed or injured, 500 children. So, David Savage, there certainly is a lot of attention to the high levels of gun violence in this country. And I'm wondering to what extent that informs the kind of thinking that is happening on the Supreme Court right now around this case that we've been discussing.
Well, as I mentioned, they have had a chance last couple of years to rule on Second Amendment challenges to laws in Illinois and California, whatever, that limit semi-automatic weapons and high-capacity magazines. There's a case pending. There's an appeal pending from Massachusetts right now on the court's conference list. They could, you know, turn around and grant that case in the next couple weeks. And so to get back to your question, I'd be very interested to see how they would split on that, because some of the gun rights advocates, Clarence Thomas among them, and I think Gorsuch, have basically said these semi-automatic weapons, there are millions of them out there. They're in common use, which was a phrase that Justice Scalia used, and that I take it they think you have a right to have such a gun. I'm not convinced that Chief Justice Roberts will go with them, because that would be a really big national decision. If they had to decide on the constitutionality of laws restricting the sale or possession of semi-automatic weapons, I think that case would be informed by the violent incidents around the country. I think John Roberts, who's a conservative, prudent guy, would be very hesitant to say you have a constitutional right everywhere, every law, by to have one of these semi-automatic rifles with a high-capacity magazine.
Hmm. Joseph Bloker, what do you think about that? Do you agree with David?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it sort of breaks down into two questions, and I'm glad, Anthony, that you mentioned the numbers and broke them down a little bit. I think that what this really comes down to is which laws are going to help us solve which kinds of problems. And, you know, the 30,000 or so gun deaths that we suffer in the United States every year is an extraordinary number standing alone, but, you know, one kind of law is not going to reach all of those. You know, as you mentioned, the majority of gun deaths in the United States every year are suicides. Mm-hmm. And that calls for a different kind of solution than, for example, a ban on high-capacity magazines, like the extreme risk protection laws, for example, that you mentioned, that some people call red flag laws. Those might be a better intervention for suicides. So the first question is, what kinds of laws, particular kinds of gun laws, could do something to stem that tide? And then the second question, and this is the one that's really before the court in some respects now, depending on what it does with mootness or in whichever case it decides to grant next. I totally agree it could grant another one right away and hear it perhaps soon after the next election. But which test it adopts will have a lot to do with which laws remain on the books. The current test in the federal courts of appeal allows for consideration of the sort of contemporary effectiveness of those laws. But the alternative test, or an alternative test, one that was championed by then-Judge Kavanaugh, would look solely to text, history, and tradition for answers about whether gun laws are constitutional. And that would be, I think, a really radical change.
It's interesting that you talked about which laws, would hit which problems within this sort of large sort of universe of gun violence. Do you buy, though, Joseph Bloker, the general idea that you hear from gun advocates in a state like Massachusetts, from where I'm talking to you? We've got some of the strictest gun laws in the country right now, and that seems to correlate with some of the lowest levels of gun violence. And what the gun advocates will tell you is that's because we have not just sort of one law in this state, but we've got red flag laws, we've got an assault weapons ban, we've given police chiefs a lot of discretion on who can get a gun permit, for example. But this general idea that a high number of gun laws tends to reduce gun violence, or at least correlates with lower levels of gun violence. A fair conclusion?
Yeah, that's really the sort of $10,000 question in a lot of ways is to what degree the correlation implies causation.
Right,
To what degree are the laws really doing the work? And there, you know, the people who have the best answers are not necessarily, you know, lawyers or law professors like myself, but scholars who work with empirics, who can go and do the math where they, you know, isolate as many variables as possible and say, okay, in this state, I'll pick Missouri. There's a famous study about Missouri relaxing its public carry restrictions. Everything else stayed constant in the state of Missouri except that they relaxed this one law. What happened to violent crime rates, for example? And that particular study, which I think I'm getting right, said that, you know, certain kinds of violent crime went up. And so that might suggest, well, loosening your gun laws is correlated and maybe suggest some causation with increases in violent crime. But that's the kind of really detailed work that would have to go into answering that question. And again, that's the kind of evidence that the current constitutional doctrine allows courts to consider. But if they were to replace that by saying we're going to look to the late 1700s or the mid-1800s for our answers, then a lot of that just goes out the window.
A few more callers getting into this conversation. Terry is calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Terry, thanks for the call. You're on the air. Please go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, this question about whether we've got the right to bear arms or not, the Constitution is pretty it's not vague whatsoever. Okay, it says you have the right to bear and keep arms, and that we do. If you want to ban assault weapons, automatic, semi-automatic weapons, well, there's hundreds of semi-automatic shotguns out there that we use here in the Midwest for deer hunting, pheasant hunting, rabbit hunting. You know, you're going to take all them from us, too? I think what you're doing is you're barking up the wrong tree.
Well, what tree should we be barking up, Terry? Go ahead.
Well, I think, and this was prudent even a couple hundred years ago in the Old West. Everybody carried a gun. Somebody got out of hand, they ended it right now. No questions about it. You didn't have mass shootings back then because of that. And I don't think you'll have that now if you go that route.
Terry, we hear you loud and clear. David, I'd love to sort of get you to respond to Terry. I mean, he's talking about the 1700s, but we're dealing with a very different level of lethality and firepower, both in terms of the ammunition, the guns, well, there's all kinds of things to consider in terms of the way things have evolved since the 1700s.
Yes, I think the history in this area is much more hazy than people have sort of understandings of what the history was. Justice Breyer likes to point out that in Boston and Philadelphia during the Revolutionary period, it was illegal to fire a gun in the city. So Justice Breyer always makes the point that if you actually want to look at history, that in the late 1700s, it was understood that cities had much stricter regulations of firearms than, say, somewhere out in the country. And so he was arguing, why couldn't Washington or Chicago have a limit on guns? Because the history suggested that that was common in the late 1700s. And I also agree with your second point. It seems strange in this time and era with, as I say, rapid-fire guns and high-capacity magazines to try to talk about, well, how does this fit with the late 1700s and people carrying, you know, guns out in the woods and shooting? I don't think the history tells us all that much that's specific and useful and relevant today.
Let's go to John, who's calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. John, thanks for the call. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I mean, you know, people have to understand the Heller decision is an exquisitely political decision that overturned all the precedent from the enacting of the Constitution up to 2008. So there is no inevitability really argument that there's a personal right to bear arms. What we need to do now, because of that decision, is get leadership to repeal the Second Amendment. We have 200 million firearms, handguns in the country. That's why we have the highest handgun suicide rate, homicide rate. It's very obvious. And we need to do something about it. And this is all a part and parcel of the gun lobby and the gun industry wanting free reign to flood the country with products that have one purpose, killing people at close range.
John, I'm going to jump in because your line is getting a little sketchy, but we absolutely heard your point. Joseph Blocher, the idea of repealing the Second Amendment as a sort of practical avenue for gun control advocates. How realistic is that?
Well, I guess two things. One, I'm not sure it's realistic at all, but it's also, I think, at least now, not necessary. The Second Amendment is not the primary obstacle to further gun regulation in the United States, at least as a matter of constitutional doctrine. Courts are not striking down a whole lot of gun laws. And the reason for that is that we don't have a whole lot of gun laws, that politically, aside from, 8 to 10 states, as we said, where there's been a lot of activity, There just aren't a lot of stringent laws out there to be struck down, but that's a matter of politics rather than a matter of constitutional doctrine. The Second Amendment, again, at least so far, recognizes both gun rights and gun regulation. And to that degree, I think the caller called it an exquisitely crafted opinion with regard to politics. I think it's also true with regard to law and history. It captures both of those things, both rights and regulation. And that history, I guess this is going back to the prior caller a little bit, is not as clear in favor of broad gun rights as I think many gun rights advocates want to believe. The caller referred to the Old West where you'd settle disputes with guns, but that's just as a matter of history not true. The gun regulation, especially in the sort of famous gun havens like Dodge City and Tombstone, Arizona, were absolutely more strict than anything we have in any United States city today. You couldn't carry a gun legally into either of those cities. So if you look to history, you'll find lots of support for gun regulation. But as David said, and I totally agree, it's just it calls for hard analogies. You know, how do you analogize between a machine gun and a musket?
Right, right. Really, really interesting. Always interesting to sort of look closely at what history actually teaches us. I want to ask you both, we only have about a minute left here, but let's assume that this case before the Supreme Court right now is tossed out. We mentioned earlier in the hour that there are other major cases around gun rights sort of waiting in the wings. What are they? What's next? David, can you take that one up?
Well, there are two types of issues. One is the one I mentioned where another challenge to a state law like Massachusetts that limits the sale or possession of rapid-fire rifles or guns and high-capacity magazines. So that's a challenge to the type of gun you can own. And the second is this issue we talked about earlier, the concealed carry permit. A lot of people, like some of your callers, have lived in New York or California, and the city or state is very stingy on granting concealed carry permits. I think it's quite possible. Those laws are being upheld. I think it's quite possible the Supreme Court will grant an appeal to try to answer the question is, do you really have a right, if you're a law-abiding person, to bear arms, to carry a gun in public?
Well, it's a fascinating set of issues, an important debate, important questions about constitutional rights and as well as about the right of people to be safe in their own communities. I want to thank my guests for being so smart around this issue. David Savage, Los Angeles Times reporter who covers the Supreme Court. Thanks so much for being with us. We're really grateful.
Thank you, Anthony. Good to be with you.
And Joseph Blocher. He's co-director of the Duke Center for Firearms Law, and he's a professor at Duke University Law School. Joseph Blocher, thank you for joining us as well. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Anthony.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast and are at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.